another Teen Wolf podcast here. We're on episode 14 this week, and it is going to be a recap of season 2, episode 9, and episode 10, which is Party Guest and Raving. As usual, you can always contact us after the episode on Twitter or on Tumblr or our email, and those are natwpodcast on Twitter, natwpodcast@gmail.com, or notanotherteenwolfpodcast.tumblr.com. You can also always join us over on Hyperbull for any of the Teen Wolf articles that we post. We're covering all of the upcoming news for Season 3, or on the podcast page on Hyperbull 2. The first episode is Party Guest, which Karen will read the recap for, and then we will talk about that.
All right, so Lydia continues to hallucinate. This time, she's attacked on the lacrosse field by Peter while the school looks on. When she wakes up, her bed is full of dirt, and Peter is sitting next to her. He wants her to invite everyone to her birthday party, and when she asks what would happen if she didn't, he shows her a scene of all of her friends dead. Peter then shows her himself in werewolf form. In the next scene, Chris is attempting to clean up the werewolf bite Derek had given Victoria. It's obvious he is much more upset than she is. As she cleans herself up, Chris talks to Gerard, who tells him that his wife is dead and a monster is now in her place. Gerard tells Chris she must die before she turns on them. Matt and Allison are in her car, having just come home after the rave. Matt apologizes to Allison about the kiss and asks what's going on between her and Scott. When she doesn't really give an answer, he leaves, only to forget his camera bag. Allison sees the pictures of her on his camera. Matt comes back and invites her inside, but she refuses and drives away. Styles and the sheriff are looking through the Beacon Hills yearbook again when they discover the connection between all of the victims. They were all a part of the 2006 swim team, and Isaac's father was the coach. Lydia throws her party, though not many people show up at first. Allison tells Scott and Styles that it's their fault she turned into the town whack job, and that they have a responsibility to get people to come to her birthday celebration. After Scott invites the lacrosse team and Styles invites his drag queen friends, the party really starts to take off. We begin to see the workings of the plan, however, when Lydia starts handing out punch laced with wolfsbane. In between scenes of the party, we see Derek's pack struggling with the full moon. Isaac is the only one who is able to find his anchor, which is happier memories of his father. We also see Victoria refusing to kill herself with pills and instead takes a butcher knife to her heart in Allison's room. The only way she could be close to her since she didn't get a chance to talk to her before. Everyone starts to hallucinate, and Scott soon realizes something is wrong. It's only when Matt gets thrown into the pool as a joke that we find out he can't swim. Jackson pulls him out, and because the cops are coming to bust them, everyone leaves. Amongst the crowd, Scott sees the Canama guarding Matt and realizes Matt is its master. In the last scene, and after she blew wolfsbane powder in his face, Lydia drags Derek back to the Hale House and resurrects Peter. So this was quite an intense episode. Both of them are pretty intense, actually, since we're getting close to the end of season two. So what were your two favorite lines from this one?
My favorite lines in this episode, my favorite sort of funny moment, which were there were not too many of them, was actually Scott on the phone to... My favourite funny moment of the episode, there weren't really very many of them, there were some sort of absurd moments, but not really funny. But the one moment I liked was Derek on the phone to Scott, where he kind of just says, Scott, can you call me back? I'm probably going to need some help, when he's, you know, making the pack deal with the full moon. Just his delivery of that line was just, to me, so funny. Like, it was sort of so... light, like that kind of thing where people restrain, you know, they're talking really lightly because they're restraining themselves from how stressed they are, and mm-hmm. it literally reminded me of, like, how someone would react if they were in a comedy movie stuck in a room looking after a bunch of toddlers or a bunch of wild puppies and kittens or something, and, you know, they were climbing all over the counters and, you know, like, you know, they were in the fridge and you know, the person's just tearing out their hair going, oh, I can't deal with this. And the way that he said, you know, being like, hey, Mom, can you come over? I'm going to need a bit of help. The way that he sort of said that to Scott reminded me of this totally, except he was talking about his little betas, so that kind of made me laugh. But as far as the other bits, the one other one-liner sort of that I liked was actually sort of between Matt and Allison when she's looking at his camera at the beginning and he's kind of trying to cover up the fact he knows that she's seen the photos that he took of her, and he kind of covers it up saying, oh, you know, there's a good candid of you on there too, and, you know, she goes through and sort of shows all of them, and he's like, oh, yeah, you know, they're just, you know, natural photos, you know, photographers call them candids. And she goes, well, police officers call it stalking. And it just interested me with that scene how much he tried to get away with it, like how much he tried to kind of lightly play it off as something that was no big deal. And it makes me wonder whether it's one of those situations where sometimes people are fully aware of how creepy they are or fully aware of how bad their behaviour is. But sometimes people aren't. Like, sometimes if people do something in a completely insular way, they don't realise how wrong it is till someone calls them out on it, if you know what I mean. They get so far inside their head that they don't realise that what they're doing is inappropriate or wrong or creepy until someone from an outside perspective is like, hey, that's weird, and they hadn't thought about it like that till then. And it just makes me wonder whether Matt was like that about Allison, whether he realized how bad he was, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I think he did. I mean, obviously that didn't stop him, but I think, you know, he definitely had an idea that it was wrong, or else he wouldn't have gone to such lengths to try to cover it up, like you said. Mm. And, you know, your line actually kind of goes into one of my lines, which Matt says in that same scene, you think I'm the kind of guy that's going to say, if I can't have you, no one can? Get over yourself. And it's like, yeah, you know, he's trying to play it off. He's trying to put her down to, you know, sort of just shrug off the fact that he was obviously stalking her and taking pictures of her when she was inside of her home and that sort of thing. Mm. So, yeah, he's pretty manipulative.
Yeah, it just seems like whenever he's sort of confronted with it by her or whatever, he becomes defensive in this way, like, you know, like he tries to make it not, you know, not a big deal. And, yeah, it does make me wonder whether that's like a prepared excuse or whether he is, you know, actually genuinely defending it because he, you know, believes what he's doing is fine. I don't know. I don't get Matt. He takes a turn, obviously, in these episodes.
Yeah.
And it's yeah.
My second line was between Scott and Stiles at the party, when Scott, you know, and Allison are sort of across the yard looking at each other, and Stiles is like, you know, what's going on with you guys? And Scott says, you know, why should I apologize? And Stiles just says, because you're the guy, it's what we do. And I really liked that line, you know, obviously for the comedy effect, but, you know, just the fact that Stiles kind of gets that, you know, we've talked about it before that he just kind of knows girls a lot better than Scott does. And so I really liked that line. Okay. So getting right into the discussion here, while we're talking about Matt, my big thing was that, okay, Allison was in the car, she saw the pictures, she was obviously creeped out for good reason, and Matt was sort of just like, you know, like we were saying, playing it off, and he was like, oh yeah, you know, you can't really appreciate the pictures on the camera, let me, you know, come on in, let me show you what they look like on the computer so you can see them better, and obviously Allison was like not having any of that. But my question is, what would Matt have done if Allison had agreed to go into his house? Like, how crazy is Matt? He's obviously been killing people, you know, via the cannabis, and he killed the one woman, too. So do we think that he would have killed Allison, or, you know, what would he have done to her?
I don't know. Like, I can't work out if his goal is to kill Allison or if he, you know, if it's that kind of thing, like that kind of weird serial killer thing, or if he genuinely likes her or thinks that he likes her, and that, you know, he might have, you know, he may have done something bad either way. Like, he might have tried to rape her or, you know, yeah, basically just probably scared her in some way. Like, this is, again, tying back into those quotes that I have no idea if he actually, when it comes to Allison, I have no idea if he realises how bad he is, you know, and that his behaviour is, you know, if he actually wants her to like him, and if he realises that he is, because if he is that manipulative, which he obviously is in certain ways, if he is that manipulative and it's not actually crazy obliviousness, surely he'd be manipulative enough to know the way to actually make himself not creepy, if you know what I mean. Like, Peter's creepy, but he's manipulative in a way that makes people, you know, that sucks people in because he's enigmatic. And Matt is sort of breaking on crazy here, and it makes me wonder if it's, yeah, at the point where he literally thinks that his behaviour towards Allison is fine until the words come out of his mouth, and then either he hears himself to her or, you know, she calls him out on it and he has to, he realises that it's not fine and that he has to defend it. But, I mean, his outburst to the party is the same thing. Like, it's all, I don't know if the outburst at the party was influenced by the punch at all, like if that was, you know, worse than his normal state.
Because, but he didn't drink the punch, right?
Did he definitely not? Like, this is what I'm trying to work out, like, whether he did.
Yeah, because he tossed the cup. He looked at it and tossed the cup. And, I mean, he could have, you know, had some before or after then, but mm-hmm. I don't think he had any.
Okay. In that case, I don't know. Like, I don't know whether he would have, whether he has, I don't know whether he thinks he has malicious intent towards Allison. I think that he does have malicious intent towards Allison, but I don't know if he thinks that he has malicious intent, if that makes sense.
Right, yeah. No, that does.
So, yeah, I think that he might have attacked her or pressured her, but in a way that probably until she screamed at him, he didn't realise was attacking, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's crazy.
Yeah.
I feel like "because he's crazy" is going to be the tagline of a lot of sentences in the next two episodes.
Yeah, definitely.
Mm. In regards to Lydia's party, I guess the first thing that I was looking at was Styles bringing his drag queen friends along, and obviously Scott bringing the lacrosse team was very sort of very funny and all of that. But Lydia, sort of her attitude towards having this party, with, you know, not sending out the invitations and, you know, expecting people to show up and, you know, either not realising or being in denial that people like her, that people are sort of are turned off from her at the moment. She is very taken aback when, you know, she opens the doors and it's Styles' drag queen friends, and they're kind of like, "We're here for the party." And she kind of looks at them and just, like, you know, takes 1 second, and then she's like, "Well, come on in." Like, kind of is all. But why is this so important to her? Like, why does it matter so much to her when it isn't actually people who care about her or whatever? I mean, like, it's all very well and good. It's a fun party. But why does it matter so much to her that she has this kind of party to celebrate her birthday when it's not actually people celebrating her birthday? Like, it's people that don't even know her, you know, given that every year apparently everyone in the whole town knows. What does that even mean to someone? Like, Styles is the only one we see actually, like, bring her a present or care that it's her actual birthday. So what's with that?
I'm not really sure, but something that just kind of got me thinking was when you said that, you know, obviously she didn't send out any invitations. Do you think she was trying to save her friends from coming to the party in case something went wrong and Peter or, you know, whatever, obviously at this point Peter isn't really real, but do you think she was actually trying to save their lives by not actually inviting anybody?
I remember actually thinking this. I didn't think it on this rewatch, but I remember thinking it the first time I watched. I'm like, oh, is this, like, her conscious self, like, trying to actually avoid the situation her unconscious self is putting herself into. I don't know. I think it's possible. Yeah, I just don't really understand these, you know, what this party was meant to be. I mean, if we're going to tie it into the whole, like, Peter hallucination thing, I have no idea how... I do not know how his resurrection worked. I do not know how his, like, why he's there talking to her. I don't understand, like, the technicalities of any of it. I don't know if we're meant to have. I don't know if it's meant to be explained now, but I still don't really understand it. I don't understand why all those people hallucinating, like, helped him, like, in some way, unless it was just to cause confusion in general. Like, I don't really understand what Zombie Lydia drugging the punch achieved, except to cause chaos. Maybe he's feeding on chaos. I don't understand, really.
I definitely don't know the technicalities either, but I think the main purpose of, like, the Wolfbane punch and all of that was maybe to distract Scott, because they knew that he would be there, and that was sort of to get him out of the way so that she could go off and drug Derek.
Possibly, yeah. I definitely didn't think of that. I've been really confused about basically the entire way that her, what he is in, you know, prior to this episode, and how his spirit is existing. Like, it's not a hallucination. That's the thing. Lydia is, I mean, the Wolfsbane effect is a hallucination, but Peter is real. I mean, she says, are you real? And he says, not yet. But it's not like she's making it up in her head. His consciousness is real and instructing her to do this. And I just don't understand how it all happened or even, like, the process that anything about it, basically. I don't get it.
It'll be really interesting in season 3 to see Lydia and Peter together and maybe get some interaction there or something, because I'm sure she's traumatized from all of this. I mean, Scott and even Stiles and Allison have been dealing with the supernatural stuff since the beginning of season 1, but Lydia's kind of being brought in late, and I'm sure she's going to be going through some sort of, you know, am I really crazy? Like, what's going on? And I'd actually like to see her and Peter kind of face to face and see how she reacts to seeing him in the flesh.
Yeah, I mean, that's the big thing, is that she, yes, in this circumstance, she was hallucinating or possessed, if you know what I mean. She was, hallucinating is not the right word, because it's, as I said, Peter was real. It's not a hallucination. It's not something made up out of Lydia's own head. But yes, she was sort of communicating with Peter's spirit, but she thought it was a hallucination, and there are bits of it where she was clearly, like, you know, possessed by him or being controlled by him in some way. But at the moment, she basically thinks that she is full-on crazy, and everyone else thinks that she's full-on crazy, like the town whack job. And it will be interesting to see her realise that she's not, like, that... you know, oh, this isn't actually me being, you know, schizophrenic or hallucinating. This is actually something out of my control that is real. So that is interesting to me. That will be interesting to me.
Yeah, it's almost too bad that we're getting that 4-month gap between season 2 and season 3, just because I would like to see Lydia sort of have to accept everything that happened, and maybe we'll still get some of that. I'm sure it's not going to be an instantaneous process.
Yeah.
But I would have liked to see what she was like right after the season 2 finale.
Yeah, for sure. And yeah, basically, I guess in regards to her party and stuff, it's just kind of sad that kind of thing was, you know, that she's, like, satisfied, or that she is, you know, determined to have, you know, a birthday party, not for people to sort of care about her, but just to, you know, have the best party, or have the best status, sort of, for having the best party as well. But oh well.
Yeah. Speaking of being the town whack job, that's a line that Allison says in this episode. She says she wouldn't be the town whack job if it wasn't for us. And I was wondering if Allison really thinks it's their fault that, I mean, Lydia's going through all of this. It's sort of just circumstance, you know? It's not like any one of them really started it. I mean, you could say that Peter did. If it's anybody's fault, it's Peter's. But Allison seems to be taking on that guilt, and I just never really understood that.
That's true, because I would have thought the way to handle that guilt was to just tell her. Like, to bring her in to the fold, if you know what I mean. I mean, I know that the more people know, the more danger there is or stuff. But if they're seeing how badly it's affected her, why would they not just be like, hey, you're not crazy, this is the deal?
Right.
Obviously, she's going to have that in season three, but the fact that Allison does have that guilt at this point, it just, I would have told Lydia at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a lot of fans feel that, you know, Lydia is so intelligent and she's so close to all these problems with Peter and Jackson and even Scott and Allison that, you know, why didn't they tell her? So I think a lot of fans are a little bit frustrated with that, but it's a good thing that we're getting it in season three.
Yeah.
Jumping back to the beginning of the episode really quick, this is when Lydia was hallucinating that she was on the football field. And we see basically the whole town watching her as Peter attacks her. And there's one woman in the crowd who is kind of like crying. She's freaking out. She's the only one that really seems to realize what's going on. And I hadn't known what that was all about. But earlier today, when I was actually looking for pictures of Laura to do a story on Hypeable, that picture actually popped up quite a few times in my search. And are we meant to believe that that is Laura in the crowd?
I have no idea. Wow. Like, so searching for Laura Hale comes up with that image, does it?
Yeah. Yep. And I mean, I never would have guessed that. I definitely caught that she was the only one who kind of realized what was going on, but I didn't know the significance of that. Okay. I had no idea who she could be.
I'm seeing what you're seeing. Like, I'm seeing the picture.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea. I mean, it could be a popular like fan theory or something like that, that she was meant to be. But wow, if it is, that's like some Buffy stuff. Like, that's like some, like, you know, planting stuff seasons early kind of thing. Like, I don't know who she's meant to be. I now need to know that. I need to know about that. Yeah, I'm basically seeing this being said. Like, I've just looked it up and I'm saying, in 209, Lydia was on the lacrosse field. They zoomed in on a girl freaking out in the audience. The girl was Laura Hale. She caught Lydia's eye due to her freaking out. And I have no idea, like, who has confirmed this. Like, I have no idea what basis in canon this has. But someone is stating it like it's a fact. So I don't know. Right. Yeah, if that is the case, I definitely haven't noticed it. I didn't know that. And, yeah, I just really need to know what the deal was with that now and, like, what that had to do with Lydia or Peter or what Lydia's connection to the Hales is, really.
Right. So, aside from the fact that it might be Laura, you know, just the fact that there was a woman in the bleachers, one person who actually did seem to realize what was going on, do you have, like, any theory of what significance that could be?
The only thing I've got right now is, and I don't know about this, but that if Peter existed after, we don't know exactly if Peter did something to himself prior to death to stop himself being killed properly or something like that. He could have, but if he didn't, or maybe he did and Laura did the same thing, maybe Laura's spirit still exists as well.
Oh. Didn't we get some hint somewhere that there may be ghosts on season three, that they might be venturing into that territory?
I don't know, honestly. I just can't work out what else it might be. I mean, I'm sure this is why I don't write television, because I don't have ideas. but yeah, that's the only thing I can think of, that, like, maybe werewolf spirits exist after death, but because Laura's not a douchebag like Peter, she didn't go bother some child to, you know, reinstate her into her body and that she's just sort of been hanging around suffering.
Oh, that's horrible.
Yeah.
Wow. Definitely interesting, though.
And being, like, watching Peter being like, no, don't do this kind of thing.
Yeah.
I see here you've asked one thing about Erica as well, which I wanted to bring up because I think I know the answer to it. You've said why can Erica withstand more pain than the other two? And why is that stated? But to me, that was actually really interesting and sort of obvious as well, in the sense of, I think it's, do you remember in a few episodes ago when we were talking about Erica's epilepsy and how Scott could sense the seizure, and that might be a thing, like an extended thing on the fact that dogs can sense seizures and that they're used for people with epilepsy?
Mm-hmm.
I think that this is an extent on biology as well, and just the sheer fact that women are known to have a higher pain threshold than men, due to the way that our bodies work and stuff like that. Like, if it is measured, women can cope with more pain than men. And I think that this is just meant to be, like, a reference to that, and that they probably, that with werewolves, it's probably even more intense, that the females are probably stronger and more able to, yeah, cope with pain and withstand pain. That's what I took from it anyway, but,
yeah, that was sort of my theory too, so that makes sense.
Yeah. It just seemed to me like another one of those moments where they sort of took something from natural biology and increased it to fit the werewolf mythology, which is really cool, and I like that they do it without making a big deal of it. Like, it's just stuff that makes sense. They don't explain it. They don't say, Scott sensed that seizure because dogs sense seizures, you know, they didn't spell it out. But to me, it just made logical sense, and I like that aspect of the show, that they do that kind of thing. In regards to those people, those werewolves, Derek used this episode to sort of teach his pack about having an anchor and going through, I guess, what's their first full moon together, and or it might be their second, I don't know. But anyway, it's, yeah, the full moon, and he's teaching them about, you know, having an anchor and keeping control and not shifting and all of that. And he explains to them the concept of having an anchor, something hanging on to something that makes you human. And he tells Isaac that his anchor, Derek's own anchor, is anger. And we've talked about this before, that the way that he uses control is via focusing on his anger. But to me, this seems, like, not correct. Like, that anger would be his most human part, because anger is, like, a primal thing, surely? Unless he's focusing on a very specific thing, like a, you know, a specific memory or something like that. But it just interested me that, you know, he thinks that anger is the anchor that will work best for him, or that he considers that the most human quality that he has.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting, and I see your problem with it, that it's sort of like a primal thing, so it would make sense that maybe that wouldn't necessarily be correct. Although, I will say that maybe his anger just allows him to focus better, that, you know, I imagine he's thinking about the fire and his family and all the pain and hatred he feels there, and using that to sort of focus him toward what he wants to accomplish, and maybe that is what allows him to have all of that control. And I also sort of wonder if maybe he's wrong, you know, that maybe anger works, but maybe it's not the best anchor for him. Maybe he'll find out that something else will work better.
Yeah, I mean, because we have obviously Isaac and Scott, who both, I mean, their anchors are both something quite calm, which, I mean, for Isaac is a bit odd. But apparently, you know, at least the memories of his father and loving his father before his father was abusive, which is just really sad. But then Scott's is obviously his love for Allison as well, which is, seems like a bit of a volatile anchor, but regardless, they both seem to make Isaac and Scott calmer people in general than Derek. And I'm not disputing Derek's control, because he has great control, but he isn't the most normal of people. And Scott and Isaac both seem to be, you know, hanging on to their humanity, I guess, like their day-to-day humanity a bit better. And it would just be interesting to see Derek change anchors, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
As I've said, you won't understand this because I know you haven't seen this show, but anyone listening to this that knows the show Avatar: The Last Airbender, it reminds me almost exactly of the bit in the third season where Zuko loses his power to firebend and has to rediscover it, because, again, it's nearly exactly the same thing, like a drive or an anchor based in something that fuels his power, and then he loses that, actually, for a good reason. Like, he becomes happier, and he becomes on the side of good or whatever. Like, he was an antagonist, and he becomes a protagonist. But the fact that his old anchor was fighting this guy, and he's not fighting him anymore, means he actually loses his powers. So it'll be interesting to see if Derek's control, like, if he gets happy because of, I don't know, a girlfriend or something, and he, like, his control, like, goes to crap, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, I could totally see that happening. I mean, we know he's supposed to be getting a love interest in season 3, so I could definitely see this being, you know, a mini plot line for the show. So speaking about anchors and all of that, and especially going back to Isaac, I just had a quick question about why we think that Isaac's father changed. We don't really have any background information for why his father was abusive, right?
No, and I mean, it seems like that when he, you know, was, you know, 11 or 12, like, at least when we see later about his sort of interaction with Matt, when Matt had the, you know, incident that led to the whole drowning and all of that, that he was very aggressive then, like, and not the greatest human being. So perhaps when, I don't know, perhaps there was a mother, perhaps the mother leaving or dying or something like that changed things, or I don't know, perhaps the son dying, like, but, you know, the other brother.
Oh, right.
But I mean, the other brother was alive at this point in when he, at least when he met Matt, so maybe he wasn't always the greatest dude, but Isaac didn't know that at the time.
Right.
Yeah. But I wouldn't be surprised if it was, like, to do with the older son dying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense to me.
Okay, in this episode, it's discovered that Harris, the teacher, that his car was at all of these, you know, all of these crime scenes, and they've charged him, and that's the situation. My question about this is that how has Harris not noticed that his car is getting taken multiple times? Like, you mentioned in that, you know, the episode with them in the library and Harris's car being outside, you know, Matt stole a car for, you know, other usage as well. How has he not noticed it getting taken multiple times if he's not, you know, seeing as he's not the master? If he had completely no knowledge of anything going on, surely he'd be like, what on earth keeps happening? Yet his car has been used for all of the murders and, you know, he's basically been framed in a way. Do you think that he actually does have some involvement, not necessarily with Matt, but that he is, maybe even under someone's thumb, like, you have to do this kind of thing, like, that someone, that he has a boss or someone threatening him that says, do this or put up with this, and he doesn't know what it is or anything like that, and it's just, he has to go along with it, because, as we've said, he's always around, and his involvement in things seems to be too much for him to have no knowledge of what's going on.
Yeah, I completely agree that it must be that he knows something, or else you're right. He would have, you know, reported his car stolen or been like, hey, you know, my car disappears for hours at a time, then it just shows back up. Like, you know, what's going on? And I guess part of that could be that maybe he's, you know, just afraid to go to the cops or something, given his previous involvement with them. But I kind of liked what you said about him maybe being under somebody's thumb. And I kind of wonder if it could be Gerard at all, because he's been mixed up with Kate before. And I mean, obviously there was the whole thing last season about her setting the fire and him basically telling her how to do that and that sort of thing. So I just sort of wonder if he's involved with the Argents more than we know he is at this point. But he's definitely creepy. Like, something's definitely going on. There's more to his story.
Yeah, it just seemed really odd to me that his car would be used multiple times and that it wouldn't be, you know, sort of without his consent in some way.
Mm-hmm. Unless he is consenting, but then, you know, what would Matt be saying? Like, hey, teacher, can I borrow your car? Like, that wouldn't exactly make sense, you know? Unless he's blackmailing him or something.
But this ties into a little bit into the next episode as well, in that Gerard knows that Matt is the Canema Master and is apparently using this in some way. And maybe Gerard is the puppeteer at this point of everything. I don't know if the usage of the car, like, lines up with that or something like that. But we're meant to assume that Scott told Gerard, which is, again, for the next episode, but we're meant to assume that Scott told Gerard about Matt being the Canema Master quite a while ago, or as soon as he knew, at least, which I guess wasn't that long ago, but I don't know. I just feel like that, yeah, that this thing about the car is weird and I don't understand, basically.
Yeah, same.
In regards to Gerard, though, in this episode, he really turns in this. I mean, we know he sucks, but the way that he addresses Chris at the beginning of the episode, like, it's, like, all falsity is, like, stripped away. Like, he's not pretending, I mean, for Allison or for anyone else. He's literally, like, he says, we all have our roles to play. You know, the grieving, you know, husband or whatever, and me, the ruthless grandpa willing to do anything to sort of protect family or whatever. And he just the tone of voice, it's like sociopathic. Like, he's just, there's none of his kind of false emotion that he usually carries around with him, or his, you know, sort of condescending to Allison. He really just, it's just cold and, like, horrible.
Yeah.
And it's all just all a pretense of anything except his sort of ruthless ambition is stripped away. Like, I think Chris knows that Gerard doesn't have feelings and doesn't care about anything, and that he knows that Gerard acts like he does, but that he truly doesn't. And in this, it's like, he just doesn't care anymore. Like, he just is not putting on that pretense anymore.
Yeah, the line that really stuck out to me here was when he says something along the lines of, don't expect me to play Poison King to your Hamlet of a son. And just how he said that. And yeah, he's so cold and ruthless and horrible. And I just, if I was Chris, I would have thrown him out of my house. But then again, he probably wouldn't really be able to do that. I mean, Gerard obviously has a lot of people in his pocket. You know, within the Hunter's ranks and all of that.
Yeah. And I mean, in regards to Victoria killing herself, it's a very difficult scene, or it's a very difficult storyline, because it's, like, really harsh. It's one of the harshest things I've ever seen on television, and you can tell that Chris kind of doesn't think it's necessary, I think. Like, he's kind of sitting there going, well, what if we could live with her as a werewolf, if you know what I mean. Like,
right.
But how strongly she must believe that it's wrong to feel like she needs to do that shows, you know, whether it's Gerard's beliefs or whether it's her own beliefs. But she, I mean, she does seem to be pretty deep in her anti-werewolfism, much more than Chris is. So, yeah, I mean, it's really horrible. There's a few things about it that I have questions about, even, because when she does end up killing herself, she, you know, she gets stabbed with a knife, but if she's already a werewolf, like, I mean, and she is already a werewolf, like, she's bitten, so she's a werewolf, it's not the moon, so she hasn't started to turn uncontrollably yet, but
mm-hmm.
she is a werewolf. would she not heal from that? Like, I just, it just, that confused me. Maybe you don't become a werewolf properly until your first full moon, and after that you have the power, but it just confused me that, that kind of wound, when we've seen the others getting stabbed and stuff, oh, maybe not directly in the heart, but...
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, that maybe this kind of answers our question before about the scene where Styles accidentally shoots the arrow at Scott, and, you know, we were wondering about the healing capabilities, is that perhaps because this is more of an instant death, like, you know, literally a knife right to your heart or an arrow right to your head, like, they can't heal from that. That's just, you're dead. You're done.
But, yeah, I mean, it just... makes me wonder if this had happened and Gerard wasn't there, whether Chris would have convinced her or tried to convince her to just, like, live as a werewolf, whether her, you know, whether his sort of love for her or, you know, his family was more important than hunting, because obviously to Gerard it's not. Gerard doesn't have any feelings, and he's...
Right.
And, you know, Victoria seems to be in agreement with him about with Gerard about that, but it makes me wonder if Chris would have tried to sort of save her against her own will.
I absolutely think he would have tried to convince her that everything was fine, that they would deal with it, but I don't think he would have been able to. Victoria is almost dead set against werewolves as Gerard is, so I think that there was really no hope there, whether or not Gerard was around.
I mean, the whole thing was played very distressingly, like Allison sort of pushing Victoria away during the episode, like when Victoria obviously tries to come and talk to her about it, or, you know, say goodbye, or even just have a moment with her. And then at the end as well, in the hospital, where she was sort of screaming, being like, this better not be another training thing, like that kind of thing. It was really hard to watch, and I mean... I won't get too much into this about myself personally, because it's a bit of a downer, but I have talked about it on Glee Chat before, but my mother killed herself as well a long time ago, I was younger than Allison was. I was quite a lot younger, but, you know, having this particular incident played out on television is very, very intense, and, like, so it's very much one of the most, you know, most affecting things I've seen in any TV show, and it, yeah, makes me really, really hate Gerard, like, more than I think any other villain in the show, and that there's some stuff in the next episode as well, some stuff that Allison says that I'm like, I think it's really, really bad that you think this, and we'll get to that, but it's just, yeah, it's just something that was, in general, like, the way it's played, like, very raw, like, that hospital scene, and the scene where Chris is talking to her before she dies as well. I mean, aside from the suicide as well, it's always really hard to watch someone knowing that they're going to die. Like, this is more of a scene where, I mean, it is a suicide, but it's more like, I guess they consider it, it's sort of more like turning someone off life support or something like that. It's like knowing someone's gonna die and being able to talk to them right before they die, even though you know that they're gonna die. That's always been something I've found really hard to watch, like, even without a suicide aspect. Like, I don't know if you ever watched House. Did you watch that series?
I've caught a few episodes, but I haven't watched it religiously.
Okay. There's scene in the end of season 4, I think, where Dr. Wilson, one of the main characters, his girlfriend, who was one of the other doctors, was in a car accident, and basically her entire systems are gone, if you know what I mean. They're like, her systems aren't going to work. She's never going to recover again. She is kept alive and woken up by, like, an entire room full of machines, you know, working her kidney and her lungs and everything like that. So she's alive and conscious, but her body is literally being kept alive by the machines. And so he and some of the other doctors talk to her and, like, say goodbye before she dies. And, like, she's conscious and she knows, I'm going to die, they're going to turn this off. I'm only being kept alive by the machines. And it kind of reminded me a bit of that, like, that real harshness of knowing, basically being really conscious of the time limit of your life and, you know, talking to someone before you die as opposed to dying accidentally or something like that. That is something that I've always found really, really hard, like, and really, really sad.
Yeah, I mean, this whole scene was super intense for me too, even though, you know, I've never gone through anything like this. It was hard to watch, and it's actually the first time that I've genuinely felt sympathy for Victoria, and it was so hard knowing, even the first time I was watching it, when you didn't really know exactly what was going to happen. You knew she was going to kill herself because that had already been discussed. And then she's trying to talk to Allison. Allison just sort of brushes her off. Mm-hmm. And it's like, for the first time, I was like, you know, oh, poor Victoria and Allison, like, I'm kind of pissed at you right now because mm-hmm. your mom genuinely needs to talk to you about something and you're just not letting her. And I can see where Allison's coming from. I mean, her mother hasn't exactly been the easiest person to deal with since everything has gone down and Allison's realized that, you know, she comes from a family of hunters. But that was really hard for me to watch too. And you can just see, obviously, Victoria loves her daughter, but I think this is the first time where she's shown that sort of emotion towards Allison, and I think that's why I sympathize with her so much here. And so it was hard to watch, but it was sort of, you know, a beautiful thing, too. But that hospital scene afterwards where Allison's crying, I'm, like, gross sobbing, like, every time I watch that. It's just so hard. And, I mean, Crystal Reed, you know, give her some props. That was just a really intense scene to watch. And it was, it makes me so sad just to see it. It's really quite horrible.
Yeah, it was. I mean, both of them, her and J.R. Bourne as well. And, I mean, Victoria Edie Mays in the episode, her acting was great as well. It was, odd. And, I mean, good, but odd that this character, like, literally the worst, like, emotional moment of the entire show is, like, this character that literally up until, like, aside from, like, 5 minutes of screen time, you hate, like, so much.
Right.
And it's, like, it just shows the strength of the story and the writing and also how awful, like, Gerard is and how bad the, you know, prejudices are as well.
Mm-hmm. My last thing for this episode of the main topics was that at the end there, how Peter comes back to life, that kind of confuses me for a lot of different reasons. But the main thing, I mean, because we don't really know how it happens, like, it obviously has something to do with the moonlight, and then it has something to do with either needing Derek's blood or needing to touch him or something with the fact that he's the alpha. But when Peter grabs him, Derek's eyes open and they turn from red to normal. And at first I thought, okay, so is he not the alpha anymore because Peter's back alive? But the vet very clearly in the next episode says, don't worry, you're still an alpha. And we know now that Peter is a beta to Derek. So I just don't know. Basically, I just don't know what happened there. Do you have any idea of, like, the logistics of all of that?
No, I mean, could it have been that he was kind of, like, waking up or going back into shock from, like, just basically morphing out of wolf form, if you know what I mean? Like, or did the eyes glow his normal wolf color? I don't...
They went to normal, like, human normal. They didn't glow anything else.
I don't know, in that case, maybe he was in, like, his body was in, like, so much pain or shock that he sort of morphed out of wolf state. I don't know, that's the only thing I can think of. The way that they kind of, if they have the wolf state on, if they got, you know, shocked or something or lost their focus, that they would actually revert back to human, or if they're weakened, they would revert back to human. I don't know if that happens, though. Like, I don't know if that's actually a canon fact, so I'm not sure.
Yeah, kind of confusing. And then the last thing I just want to say with this episode is we're going to give out a little shout out to Chantel Rhodes once again, because she was the walk-on winner of course, for the contest for the season. And she had her little role in this episode where she got to dunk Styles in the pool to kind of sober him up. And we have an interview coming with her to you guys probably about a week after this episode airs. And it's going to be really exciting, and we're really excited to have her on. So definitely look forward to that.
Yeah, that will be awesome. And her scene was definitely one of the funnier moments in a very heavy episode. You guys will enjoy hearing from her about that. So we'll talk more about that in that particular aspect in our chat with her, which will come up after this episode. Episode 210, Fury, is, well, it's an episode, isn't it?
Oh my goodness, yeah.
I literally had to stop this episode midway through and be like, I'm not processing this properly, I need to go back and start again, because I was just like, it was too much, man. But anyway,
yeah.
So in this episode starts where we see in a flashback the scene between Matt and Jackson where Matt gives him the camera. We then see from Matt's perspective what happened where he goes and wirelessly connects his phone to the camera to see what Jackson's up to. I'm not 100% sure that is like a factual thing you can do with technology, but it happens in the show. And like, it's not a webcam, it was just a camera. But anyway, it happens in the show. So he sees Jackson turn into the Canama, and then when the Canama approaches Matt's car, they put their hands up to each other at the window. We also see flashbacks in this moment of Mr. Lady's death by the Canama, interspersed with Matt putting up his hand and then seemingly becoming the Canama master. Scott and Styles convince the sheriff that Matt is the killer. The three of them go to the sheriff's station where they view footage of the hospital, knowing the killer had gone in there himself to murder the young mother. When they see that Matt, the killer, talked to Scott's mum, they call her and confirm that it was Matt. When Scott goes to the front of the station to tell the officer to let his mum in to the station, they find the cop dead and Matt has pointed a gun at him. The vet wakes Derek up using a dog whistle, which was hilarious, and tells him that he needs the one person that doesn't trust him, Scott. Gerard, meanwhile, gives Allison a letter from her mother and tells her that if it was him, he would want Derek to pay for what he did. Styles locks up his father, and Scott and Styles destroy all of the evidence at Matt's request. Request is a loose term. Derek shows up, but Jackson has already taken care of him, and he is paralyzed from the neck down and falls through the door. Jackson quickly paralyzes Styles as well, and he lays out with Derek. Scott and Matt go to the front of the station when Scott's mother arrive, and Matt shoots Scott in front of his mum. When she's locked up, Matt explains that he wants the bestiary from Scott, which he hopes will explain why he's turning into a Canama himself with patch of scales. When Matt's out of the room, Derek tells Styles it's because Matt broke the rules of the Canama and the universe is trying to balance itself out. Matt explains to Scott what happened to him, that he had gone over to Isaac's house as a child to trade comics and the drunk swim team tossed him into the pool. He couldn't swim and he actually drowned. Isaac's father saved him but told him never to tell anyone and blamed Matt himself for falling in. The lights go out and the hunters start shooting up the station. Matt and Scott run, but Scott bumps into Allison, who's hell-bent on finding Derek and killing him. She tells Scott to stay out of her way. The Canama and Matt find Allison first, but Matt doesn't get a chance to kill her. When he leaves, Chris takes her to safety. Matt knocks the sheriff out, and that's when Derek and the Canama show up. They begin to fight when Scott comes in and attacks the Canama. Scott's mum sees him as a werewolf and is terrified. He runs off and bumps into Gerard and tells him that it wasn't supposed to go this way. Gerard tells Scott to relax and to leave Matt and Jackson to him. Derek overhears all of this. In the final scene, Gerard confronts Matt and drowns him in the river, which Peter sees from afar. Gerard then turns to the Canama and replaces Matt as the Canama master. So, this episode is the episode where all the things happened.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, this episode, I think, has quickly turned into one of my favorite ones. It's just so intense, and we get a lot of answers, and it's just, it's so good.
It is a favorite. It's definitely, in terms of good quality, but it's literally hard to get through. Like, it's hard to, it's so much. Like, it's really, it's a very big episode. So what were your favourite lines in this one? I know that when I rewatched it, I was like, I knew there was one of yours was going to be this. So yeah. Go ahead.
You know me so well. Yeah. The first one is from the vet talking to Derek when he says, unfortunately, the one person you should trust doesn't trust you. And I really love this line for so many reasons. First of all, the vet is so aware and so wise, and I just really, really enjoy every time he's on the screen. And also just the fact that, yeah, Derek really, you know, he needs to patch up that relationship with Scott if he's ever going to hope to have Scott on his side, you know, for real. I mean, Scott said, okay, you know, I'm going to be a part of your pack now, but he really isn't. You know, he's not there voluntarily. He's there because it's what needs to get done. And although Scott isn't necessarily, you know, the smartest guy or the best werewolf or, you know, anything like that, he's a really good person, and I think Derek could benefit from that if he just tried harder to get Scott to trust him and to be trusting of Scott. You know, it's a two-way street. I think that would open up a lot of possibilities for both of them.
I've read, and I don't think this is true. I don't necessarily think this is true, but I've actually read a really interesting, like, meta, like, piece of theorization about that the person that Deaton meant when he said that was Stiles and not Scott. There was something to do with the way that he delivered the line, like he said, the one person you should trust doesn't trust you at all, and you know, Derek says Scott, and then Deaton automatically says he's with Stilinski right now. Anyway, I'll try and find it for you later, because I think the show meant Scott. Like, I do think that the show meant Scott. I think that that's the obvious answer. But the explanation for why it could have meant Stiles and, like, the reasoning behind it was really amazing. And I was like, yeah, that's actually really clever. And just because the delivery of, I think it was just because the delivery of Deaton saying he's with Stilinski right now, it sounded a little bit like Derek could have known that he meant Stiles, that Scott was the answer to finding Stiles, and that Stiles was the end game, if you know what I mean, because just the way he says he's with Stilinski right now, like, it was a weird delivery, and it's interesting. I don't necessarily think it's true, but it was really interesting to me, and right. I see how I kind of, the delivery, watching it again, the weirdness in the delivery makes me remember that, yeah, that it was kind of somewhat plausible. But he's right about Scott. Like, I don't understand why he doesn't. I mean, I still don't really understand on Scott's part, like, why he's so untrusting when he's got so many other things to be untrusting about, if you know what I mean. Like, there's so many people out there worse than Derek that I don't understand why he has to be so reluctant to actually go all in with him. So that always hurts me.
Yeah. So I'm assuming this next line is the one that you knew that I was going to pick. Yeah. This is the scene between Matt and Scott when they kind of separate themselves from Stiles and all of that, and Derek, because they're currently paralyzed. And he has this whole long speech, and if I, you know, could have put it in it, the whole thing in here, I probably would have, because I just really enjoyed the scene. But when Matt says, Jackson is my fury, I just really loved that line, for a lot of different reasons. Obviously, the whole Greek myth connection is, you know, makes my little nerd heart beat faster. But just, like, Matt feels that this is justice, and he's using Jackson to carry out this justice. And I really like how crazy Matt is. I know that sounds weird, but I love crazy Matt. And I think that's one of the reasons why this is quickly becoming one of my favorite episodes, is because he's absolutely insane, but he justifies everything. And I'm not saying that it's necessarily a logical justification and that, you know, it's okay that he's killing all of these people. But I just like the way that he sort of handles all of this, and how he says, you know, Jackson is my fury, and and he kind of gives reason to everything that's happening. Like, he's justified this revenge, you know, that it's a good thing that it's coming to him. And also, really quick, just the title of the episode, we've talked about this many times before, about how they always have double meanings. I just really love, you know, Fury. Obviously, you have Matt's anger, but then you also have, like, the Furies that Matt was talking about, and all of those different meanings just stacked up in one single word. Like, these people are so brilliant. It just, they're amazing.
That whole scene was actually, I really noticed how, like, it was a really long scene for a monologue, if you know what I mean. For, not exactly a monologue, but, like, Scott had a bit of back and forth, but for a scene that wasn't an action scene, for a dialogue scene, it was incredibly long for Teen Wolf, and it was really intense. Like, and it was, this very much, like, building up and breaking down of Matt and his craziness, and it was, you know, he was clearly not with it. Like, even when he first came into the police station, and he's, you know, talking to Stiles and the sheriff initially, it's, you know, he's crazy, you know, and I mean, I really like the way that Sheriff sort of says to him, tries to be, you know, the good dude, and is like, I guarantee you there's a solution that doesn't require a gun, kind of thing. But I actually had pulled a quote from that scene as well, that whole speech, which was basically just when he's sort of going on about the Furies and arrest us, he just kind of stops and is just like, you have no idea what I'm talking about, do you? And Scott's, you know, like, oh no, yeah, I do. It's the guy that stabbed out his eyes. And Matt just yells, that's Oedipus, you dumbass. And I was just like, the reason I picked it was because I was like, this would be me in that scenario if I was that crazy. The thing that would end up with me snapping would be like someone's random ignorance of like some like of literature. I'd just be like, how naive are you? Come on now. Like, I'd be like because I always get told apparently that I know a lot of facts. I don't think that I know a lot of facts, but apparently I know a lot of trivia, or I know a lot about certain subjects, or, you know, certain literatures and things like that. And I don't think I'm that smart, so I assume that if I know something, that it's, like, something that's generally known, if you know what I mean? And so I get really frustrated if people don't. Yes. And so, like, if I was, like, Scott, and I'd be like, come on now! And I just, him snapping at him getting the reference wrong, just, I was just like, I actually relate to you right now, and it's really bad.
Yeah. I think maybe that's why, that's another reason why I like the scene so much, is because I am right there with you. My best friend always tells me, like, how do you know all of this stuff? And it's, I don't know, I just know it. Like, doesn't everybody know this?
Yeah.
And so, like, yeah, that would have been me.
We're so bad. But yeah, I was just, it just got me, man. I was just like, oh, I feel you. It was quite a complex reference to make. Oedipus is I would say, pretty well known. Like, you know, people know about the Oedipus complex, and they know that, you know, he, you know, whatever, stabbed out his eyes after having a relationship with his mother. Orestes is one that I don't know if people know that much. I know a fair bit about it because reasons. There are such complex reasons. But if you're a fan of Les Miserables, this is so complex, it's not even funny. There's a huge reference to Orestes and Pylades, the like his sort of partner in the original text in the book of Les Mis. It's they compare characters to it, and it's like a thing. And so, I mean, aside from just Greek mythology in general, and I know about the Furies, but that particular character is someone who I'm quite familiar with. And Oedipus is a whole other story. And I was just like, no, Scott, that's so different. They're like, that would be like comparing Batman and Spider-Man. Like, how do you not, do I need to put it in this language for you? Like, kind of thing. And I don't know, I don't think Spider-Man or Batman ever slept with their mothers, because their mothers are dead. This has gone to a place.
I was just going to say, did we really just turn mythology into, like, superheroes?
They are superheroes, though. Anyway, moving on. End scene. Okay. The other line I liked was when Matt was kind of having his whole, hey, so I've learned about everything that's going on, you're all freaks. And, he, you know, he's kind of jibing Styles, like, except you, Styles, you're the useless human, aren't you? And, you know, what do you turn into? And Styles just says, abominable snowman. But it's more like a wintertime thing, you know, seasonal. And I just love that, like, in that scenario, like, when he's got a gun pointed at him, he's still not willing to, like, give an inch or let himself be insulted or, like, get rid of any of his snark. Good old Styles, he has a death wish.
Yeah, he just deadpans that line, too, yeah. And I love it. He's so fearless, you know, like you said, with that gun pointed at him, and he couldn't let it go. He's so angry that this is just how he lets it all out, and that was a really great line.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry. I just really relate to Matt right now.
Yeah, I know.
I'm just thinking about it. No, it's just like, I don't know, it's so bad. Anyway, moving on into the actual discussion, where do we want to kick this off? Oh, the first thing that I wanted to say was the whole thing, I mean, this is sort of, you get the flashbacks at the beginning of the episode, and then Matt explains, he literally spells out everything that, I guess just in case for anyone that missed it. Matt, when he's talking to Scott, kind of spells out, like a Bond villain, every step of his plan and everything that had happened that got him to this point, which I kind of appreciated because usually I'm like, this is very expositional and it's stupid, but I was confused, so I allowed it.
Yeah, and he's just sort of crazy, so I can see why he would just, you know, verbalize, go on that rant about it. Yeah, it was very natural. It didn't feel like exposition to me.
Yeah, but anyway, so what we establish here is that the Kanema killed Mr. Leahy before Matt was the official master, or at least before Matt knew he was the master, by the sheer force of Matt's will, like by Matt's instinct, by Matt, you know, having that hatred and that, you know, I guess wishing that he was dead or that violence. The Kanema went out and performed the task without knowing that he was in control of it, and then it was only after that that he'd, you know, came to Matt and, you know, presented himself, and then that Matt knew he was the master. So, I mean, first of all, that just shows, I mean, how strong that force of will must have been of Matt with, you know, his feelings towards Mr. Leahy, and whether he'd been carrying that around the whole time or whether, you know, he saw him for the first time and it all re-emerged, if you know what I mean. And he also mentions taking the pictures, like that he did it. He would take the picture and then Jackson would take their life, which was a really lame line. Sorry, guys, but it was not great. Regardless, so do you think that he had to take, once he knew what he was doing, do you think he had to, like, put a certain intention behind the pictures or what? Because the last part of that whole theory is that he took a lot of pictures of Allison, and obviously he didn't necessarily want Allison dead until this episode, or maybe he did, I don't know, but do you think that the Kanema's attacking of Allison in this episode was to do with Matt actually wanting her dead, or just her being there and attacking him and it defending itself?
I actually don't think the pictures have anything to do with it. I think that's what Matt thinks, but I think it's more about the intention and his thought process than the actual pictures. And I think that maybe he was just like, oh, you know, I happen to take this picture of this guy and now he's dead. This is how it works. But I don't actually think that's how it works. And something that kind of confuses me here is, like, I get the timeline and I get everything that happened between the Kanema and Matt, but the bond between them, the Kanema, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the Kanema killed Leahy before Matt and the Kanema had their little window, you know, hand thing going on there. So how was there a bond established between Matt and the Kanema before Matt really knew that the Kanema existed? Why did the Kanema choose to latch on to Matt?
You know, that's what I'm thinking, like, because that's what I was trying to puzzle out at the start, whether the flashbacks of the killing of Leahy was before the flashbacks of him meeting the Kanema, and then when he explained it, it was that. And it seems like that it was that Matt's instincts were just so strong that the Kanama latched onto it, if you know what I mean. He was projecting so much. Like, he was the person in town that had the most strong projecting feelings of killing for vengeance, if you know what I mean.
Okay, yeah, that does make sense.
And I'm just saying how strong it must have been for that to be the case, if you know what I mean, for it to...
Yeah.
For him to have activated the Kanama without realizing it.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense to me. So, this is kind of a funny line, but I kind of started thinking more into it, and so I just kind of want to run this by you really quick. But when Scott and Stiles are trying to convince Stiles' father that Matt is the Kanama master, obviously, you know, the sheriff doesn't know that's exactly what he is, but that he's the murderer. Mm-hmm. And they figure out that it has something to do with the swim team, and the sheriff asks, you know, why would anybody want the swim team dead? And Stiles just says, isn't it obvious? Our swim team sucks. They haven't won in like 6 years, which is, you know, hilarious. And obviously he's just pulling, you know, for any answer he can get. But the thing is, that 6 years kind of stuck out to me. And the whole thing with Derek, like, so they haven't won a championship or anything since Derek has been on the team. Is that, you know, what we're supposed to insinuate from this?
Do we know that Derek definitely was on the swim team? I mean, in the book,
right.
What I'm more thinking is, like, what it would have been like if Derek had been on the swim team at that time and he would have ended up being one of the Kanama's victims, if you know what I mean.
And I mean, he wasn't in the picture, so...
Yeah. Because we know, I mean, if the book is factual, I think he swam, but they wouldn't have him compete because he was too good or something like that, or, like, he swam for his own sake, but that his family were, that they didn't let them do the competition. I can't remember if he was on the swim team or not, but I think that he, in the flashbacks, it sounds like that he's meant to be a star athlete, so... You know,
right.
We'll see. Maybe he was. So it definitely could coincide with that. You know, he's clearly a good athlete, whether he was on the team or not.
Yeah, because what I was thinking, I mean, obviously he wasn't in the picture. We don't know for sure if he was on the swim team, but he is meant to be a star athlete. Mm. We learned that, you know, from some of the spoilers that are coming out. And maybe... The situation is that 7 years ago, Derek was on the swim team, and then maybe 6 years ago, the fire happened and he wasn't on the swim team anymore, and that's why they haven't been winning since then or something like that. But I was just curious if you thought, you know, maybe it could have something to do with Derek.
Yeah, and I mean, when was the incident meant to have happened with Matt as well? Was that meant to have been... around this same time, like 6 years ago? Like, all of these things happened 6 years ago. Like, I don't...
Yeah.
You know, it seems like that was a very interesting time for Beacon Hills. And,
yeah.
You know, whether... Because it's not mentioned if Derek, you know, knew all these people that were being killed. What also interests me, this is a little thing, is at the very least, one of the hunters who was on... You know the hunter that died that was on the swim team? The one that
yep.
they brought in? If he was on the swim team, he was at Beacon Hills. And if he was in Beacon Hills 6 years ago, it was at the same time Derek was. And so it's interesting that he became a hunter, like how someone actually from Beacon Hills would become a hunter, because the Argents aren't originally from Beacon Hills. I mean, they've been through there a few times, clearly, because they know about werewolf activity. But to have someone who like might have like grown up with Derek become a hunter, like I wonder if he knew Derek was a werewolf at high school or, you know, anything like that. I mean, that character's dead. Right. I'm never going to see him again. It's just a little thing, but it's just an interesting thing to me.
Yeah, that is interesting.
In regards to Derek and Deaton, then, now, what we said here is that Deaton saves Derek and he says, you know, oh, you're the one my sister talked about, like, you know, our advisor, our family guru or whatever it is that he's saying. But... You know, he says, you're the one. But Derek has met Deaton, like, a lot of times before. Like, did he not realize before that this guy that knows about, like, magic werewolf pixie dust might have been somewhat significant. Like, how, my curiosity is, like, did he, yeah, how did he not realise that Deighton was significant prior to this, or what made him realise that Deighton, you know, was this, you're the one that he was talking about, the advisor to his family or something like that?
Maybe it was just because this was really the first time that they're one-on-one, and that Deighton actively went to go help Derek, whereas before it was like Scott going to Deighton and then him sharing his knowledge. Maybe he just didn't put two and two together before, and now he's like, oh, okay, you know, all the puzzle pieces are starting to come together, and I think I know who you are now.
True, like, maybe he hadn't realized before, but still, like, how many humans are there around there that have a magic spice rack of, you know, like, I was a bit, like, about that, but maybe he, you know, maybe he just thought he was someone that was sort of associated with the Hunters, maybe he didn't realize it, and maybe this advisor role is, like, something really significant, like, you know, maybe there are lots of people out there that know about werewolves, or, you know, a few people out there, and that it wasn't surprising to come across someone who knows about werewolves, but he didn't realize that this person was this big, dramatic role, like, you know, whatever we're going to call it, like the watcher of the Hale family or whatever, if you know what I mean.
That actually is one thing that sort of confused me, because what type of advisor would a family of born werewolves need? Like, I could understand Scott wanting, you know, a sort of mentor to help him through the process and, you know, teach him all these things about werewolf lore. But you would think that a family of born werewolves would sort of pass that information down generation to generation, and they would very much keep to themselves. So what kind of advisor would the Hale family need then?
Yeah, I have no idea. That's, you know, that's something I hope we'll find out next season, but maybe just being born a werewolf doesn't necessarily mean that you know everything, and maybe people are, you know, it's just not their specialty subject. Like, maybe they're going out there trying to live life, and that they're not necessarily the ones researching all of the herbs and spices or whatever, or, you know, all of the lore. Maybe the werewolves themselves, this is very existential, but maybe the werewolves don't want to just be werewolves, if you know what I mean. They don't want to necessarily, since they are the ones having to deal with being werewolves, maybe being werewolves isn't all they want to be. They just want to, and if they want to be normal and not necessarily focus their entire existence on how much of a werewolf they are and dealing with their werewolfiness, that they have this guy who does the werewolf legwork for them. I don't know. That's the only thing I can think of.
I wonder if he could be some sort of ambassador between the Hunters and the werewolves. Because he sort of has a foot in both worlds, you know what I mean?
Mm. And, I mean, he says he knew Derek's mother, so I'm assuming we're definitely going to see that soon. And if he knew Laura as well, he sounds very disappointed in Derek's performance. I love that he says, you know, don't worry, you're still an alpha, but as usual, not a particularly competent one. Like, you know, maybe he can teach, you know, Derek how to be a better alpha, or at least he's trying to.
So I guess we can talk a little bit about Allison right now. I see you have a little bit here. Why don't you go first, and then, because my point's kind of a little bit after that, but your thing is about Allison clearing her room of all of her stuff.
Yeah. Basically, I mean, sort of, I'm going to tie this into Gerard, first of all, because I need to kind of explain this. Basically, Gerard gives Allison the note from her mother, which I am not 100% sure is from her mother. I think that the one that he handed to her was something manipulative that he himself wrote, because Victoria mentioned writing the letter, like writing, before she died, she was like, I'll go upstairs and write the letter, not letters, and she did write one to explain away the suicide, but this is a second letter, and I get the feeling that it might be fake, like something to manipulate Allison, and that is like the most screwed up thing I've ever seen, because, you know, to do that, like to a daughter with her mother. It just made me really, something about it just sat really oddly, like the fact that we didn't like hear it read aloud, like the fact that we know how horrible Gerard is. And I just, Yeah, I just, the thing that comes back to it is I'm not sure whether Victoria would want to put Allison in that kind of danger. Like, I'm sure that Allison would be told the truth about why Victoria killed herself, that, you know, that she was, going to become a werewolf and that she didn't want to become a werewolf. But I also feel like that, you know, Gerard's doing it as a way to try and manipulate her into basically snapping and killing the werewolves. That's the only reason that he's done it. Like, it's not actually because he has feelings. He's done it because he is trying to get her to break. And she does. I mean, she reads it, and then, yeah, she basically takes Gerard's words to heart about vengeance and all of that, and it has this really interesting moment where she basically starts trashing her room, but it's not just like, oh, I'm angry and I'm trashing my room. She basically starts clearing out and throwing out and moving everything that's like normal girly kind of, this is my room and I'm normal and I have a normal pretty little life, and even like ripping out some of her clothes, and she kind of, we get back to her and it's just basically, she's just sort of become this very Spartan soldier, like in kind of black combat gear and no decorations, no distractions, and just her and her weapons, and she just really, really changes. And that was a really interesting moment and a really interesting like way to show that change, I thought.
Yeah, definitely. I like your description of it being sort of Spartan, because it's true. She's kind of all business at this point. And even the scene downstairs when she's talking to her father and Gerard, when, you know, she's like, I want Derek to pay for what he did. And Chris is like, okay, you know, but he's not the only werewolf in town. She's like, well, you know, I can prioritize, like, Derek needs to go first. And if anybody gets in the way, like, we'll take them out too if it's necessary. And it's just, yeah, she's completely changed. This is really the turning point for her character and how crazy she sort of gets later on in the season. Just to go back really quick to what you were saying about the letter and whether or not it's a fake, I never actually considered that it would be a fake. However, that makes a lot of sense to me. I think Victoria could have written the letter. I think that's something that she would do. But on the other hand, I can definitely, definitely see Gerard writing the letter as well and using it to manipulate Allison. I do not for a second believe that, you know, he's beyond doing that. That's something that's basically his MO. So that's just sort of really interesting to me to think that maybe he did write it and that, you know, just one more string he's pulling, you know? He's just got his claws everywhere.
I mean, it's just basically everything that he said when he gave it to her. I just don't believe him. And mm-hmm. So, like what he said about, you know, even if she did write it, it barely even matters what the letter said, because he basically delivered it with a completely manipulative message. Like, he delivered it, even when he was like, oh, no, it doesn't matter, darling, it can wait. Yeah, that was a lie. Like, it was, uh-huh. it was a tool, it was a lie. And the message he delivered with it was that it was, that this is what it should make you feel and you should make you react like, because they want her, or he wants Allison to act a certain way. You know, he's doing it because he knows that Allison knows that being a werewolf is something you can live with because, you know, of Scott and everything like that. He knows that Allison knows that her instant reaction might not have been like, but why did she have to kill herself, if you know what I mean? Later on, she says, you know, oh, Scott's not the one who forced my mother to kill herself. And I'm like, forced? I'm like, you know Scott, and you even know Derek. You know that these people are people, and that it's not, saying that Derek forced your mother to kill herself is, like, a pretty strong thing. And basically, I think that Gerard knows that Allison wouldn't necessarily blame the werewolves unless he really planted it, if you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, I completely agree. I think you're right that it doesn't really matter what the letter said. It's just the fact of how Gerard delivered it to her and all the crap that he was spewing I mean, she's so vulnerable at that moment and, you know, so confused and so angry and upset and hurt and lost. And he just weaseled his way in there and said what he had to say and totally, you know, turned her. I mean, it was definitely, regardless of the letter, Gerard said what he needed to say to get Allison on his side, and it worked.
And then, I mean, downstairs when they were talking about the strategy and all of that and like, sort of deferring to her leadership, that was all manipulation as well. That was, like, him pretending that Allison was happy, the one with the control. Like, it wasn't genuine at all. And she wasn't running off strategy. She was running off emotion and, like, running off complete vulnerability, but Gerard was manipulating her into thinking it was strategy. And it was all very messed up. It was like he was really taking advantage of her a lot. Like, it was really weird.
Yeah, and speaking of that, and when she says if any of his pack members get in the way, you know, we'll take care of them too, that sort of thing. When Scott and Allison run into each other at the sheriff's station, she sort of points the crossbow at Scott and, you know, says, look, you really need to kind of, like, give me my space right now, like, you need to just watch out and go somewhere else. Do you think she really meant that? Do you think that she, I mean, I have a really hard time thinking that even at this point she's so broken that she would have injured Scott. But at the same time, she had been fighting for the fact that Scott was a human being first and werewolf second, which I think translates to the other characters as well. Even if she wasn't as close to them, she was sort of like, you know, on the werewolf side. And then we'll see in the next few episodes, she kind of goes crazy and just starts, like, that one scene, starts shooting Boyd and, you know, not even killing him, but just injuring him. And that was really horrible to watch. Do you think that she would have done something to Scott, or do you think that was just to sort of get his attention?
I think that she might have in that mindset. I mean, she's in a terrible place, and it's completely irresponsible for, you know, for them to have let her even be involved, like, when she was clearly unstable. But I think that Gerard thinks that, he clearly thinks that a loose cannon is, like, a very powerful tool or a very useful tool because he made Kate. Like, Kate was a complete whack job, and it clearly started the same way, or something like that. So, yeah, I think that she probably would have done something and that she probably wasn't in the best state of mind to, you know, be involved, to be making decisions, to be hunting at all, but that Gerard was trying to make her into the kind of, like, yeah, loose cannon that Kate was, and, you know, get rid of any of those pesky boundaries she might have that, you know, Chris still has.
Right, like logic and a heart.
Yeah, those damn things. One moment in this episode that I really liked was the back and forth we get with Derek and Stiles paralyzed on the ground, which is funny and cute, but it's also just really cool to me. I think this is my favorite moment of Derek and Stiles' interaction in the show. Like, I like a lot of their development together, but I really like this moment, because they're just really in tune with each other, like, I guess because they're literally both in the same position, but they kind of, when everything's going on around them or when they're being addressed, they really defer to one another. Like, you know, something happens and their reaction is to kind of look at each other rather than look at, you know, the Stiles to look at Scott or something like that. I guess it's because at this point they literally know they are on the same page right now and that they are the ones having to look after each other or put up with each other in this certain moment. But I just really like that in this scene, it becomes a very Derek and Stiles dynamic. Like, it becomes a very, as opposed to, you know, Stiles and Scott being the team, as soon as they're put into a situation together, they become a team, and it makes me laugh. But it just also makes me, as usual, really interested in the idea of these characters as people and how much they could benefit from each other if they do, you know, end up working together more. But I really like the bit where, you know, Matt is kind of teasing them and Derek says, why don't you get down here and I've still got teeth, why don't you get a little closer and we'll see how helpless I am. And Stiles is just like, yeah, bitch, into Derek's neck. And I just really like that. I don't know why, I just found that so...
How he says that, though, is just, it's so funny.
It just, yeah, and it just reminded me of, like, and even when, I mean, this is Scott as well, like, they both, as I've said, Derek is definitely not the worst person out there, and, like, when Scott, I mean, when Derek shows up at the station, even though he's paralysed, before he is paralysed, Scott opens the door and he's like, oh, thank God, when he sees Derek, and I don't know if he means that in a, like, oh, thank God, it's not my mum, or, oh, thank God, help is here, but I took it as, oh, thank God, help is here, and I'm like,
yeah, that's how I took it.
If you're willing to accept his help, you should be a bit nicer. But anyway, Scott. But yeah, Stiles and Derek in this was just... yeah, they're just... I think it just always happens when two people are smarter than the person who they have in common, if you know what I mean. There is always a good sort of camaraderie, and they are both smarter than Scott, so... I think that kind of is what makes the dynamic interesting, but this is, yeah, this is probably my favourite in the series of them interacting, and just because of the, they're just so quick when they talk to each other, they're just, their back and forth is quick, like they are close, and it comes purely from how smart they both are, if you know what I mean. Even though Derek is a bit fail, he's still not dumb, if you know what I mean.
Right, yeah.
My other question was actually, I mean, we're about to sort of get to the end of the episode, which you have a thing about, but the other thing that I had was in regards to Gerard at the police station. There's a moment where he's just, like, lurking outside and not contributing, really, like, when Allison and Chris and everyone are attacking, he's just sort of standing there lurking. And he sees someone outside the police station. Like, he looks over and there's someone standing there in a leather jacket and then they turn around and walk off. And who is this? I mean, is it... It's not Jackson because he's in Canima form and he ends up naked when he turns back. Like, is it Scott? Is it Peter?
It's Peter, yeah. I looked really closely at that because I wasn't sure either at first, but it was definitely Peter.
Okay. And what was it meant to achieve that Gerard saw him? Like, was it just meant to
what I took from it was that he saw him, and who knows if he actually saw that it was definitely Peter or not, but the thing that really stuck out to me was that Gerard didn't go after him. I mean, if he's a hunter, you know, he obviously needs to either go after a werewolf if he sees one, or even the fact that if they're was a random person walking around to get them out of the way or something like that, and he didn't. He just let them go. And to me, that was sort of significant in that, you know, he has one objective here, and he doesn't really care about anything else, and he doesn't really care about the hunting aspect anymore either.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, we later see, you know, obviously Scott pull him aside and be like, what the hell are you doing? We had a deal, and which Derek overhears, which is, must have been a bit hard for him. But how much do we think Scott has told Gerard at this point? And, like, at what point did he, you know, how much has he been telling him? And, you know, what kind of things? Like, he said that he'd been saying stuff about Derek's pack and all of that. Like, just their identities? Or what kind of thing do you think it means?
I think he's probably been talking to him since Gerard stabbed him outside of the hospital, because that's sort of when they first, when Gerard kind of confronted him for the first time. So I'm sure that's where it began. As far as what he told him, I think Scott does say something along the lines of, you know, I told you that it was Jackson. I told you, you know, where he would be, or, you know, something like that. He's definitely been feeding him quite a bit of information.
Which is, like, something I didn't even really, the first time I saw it, I didn't really suspect, like, until that point.
Yeah, me neither.
Like, I was like, Oh, and I was trying to piece together, like, when it would have happened and what he would have got from him and stuff like that, because it's pretty bad. I mean.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because they don't hint at that at all. It just sort of comes out of left field. And not that that's necessarily a bad thing, but it was really surprising and kind of took me off guard that, you know, Scott would be doing that. And obviously we learn later why he was doing that and more about that whole thing. But yeah, it was just, you know, they didn't hint at it at all. Okay, so crazy Gerard. I feel like we could use the word crazy to describe like nearly everyone in this in this entire show, but Gerard definitely takes the cake with this one. My thing is that okay, he heads off Matt after Matt escapes when obviously his whole plan kind of goes down the toilet and the hunters show up and all of that. And Gerard obviously wants to kill Matt so that he can become the Cannimus master. Gerard could have done this in 100 different ways. He could have shot him, he could have broken his neck, he could have, you know, run him over with a car, anything. But no, he decides to drown this kid who obviously has this horrible fear of drowning. And it's just so incredibly sick to me that he would do this. I mean, just think of the terror that Matt went through when he died. And granted, okay, I mean, Matt's not exactly the greatest guy. I mean, he's been killing all of these people, but Gerard right here is just, I mean, if there was no turning point before, you know, for him to get better or anything, like this is when he just really, really steps over that line.
Yeah, it's cruel. I mean, there's no other word for it. Matt has, you know, caused all these people to die, but Matt is also clearly seriously mentally ill. Like, it's not even just like, oh, he's crazy. He's not okay. Like, Matt is clearly not actually a functioning person. He's crazy. Like, he's not, you know. Gerard is like cold. And while I'm sure that he's, you know, probably a clinical psychopath or something, he is a, you know, he's a cold, calculated human being, and he's being cruel, and that's just so much worse. Like, it's just so,
Yeah.
yeah, it's just so messed up.
How I sort of differentiate them is that everything Matt did was reactive. It was sort of like a defense mechanism where, you know, this happened to him when he was young, so now he wants revenge. Whereas everything Gerard is doing is proactive. It's going out there and doing things to benefit him. It has nothing to do with being slighted. I mean, he says that it is, that it's about Kate and all of that, but it's not. We know that by the end of the season, that it has nothing to do with that, really. It's his own selfish ambitions. And that's sort of where the line is drawn for me between the two of them and why that makes Gerard so much worse.
Oh yeah, Gerard is the worst in general. Like, he's just the worst character ever. His motivations are so bad. Like, I've never seen a worse character, I don't think.
Yeah, he's really horrible.
My last question was just about Peter witnessing that death at the end. Does that achieve anything? I can't remember why it was significant that he was there, and that he, I mean, that he now knows Gerard is the master. I mean, obviously, I'm probably going to realize more when I watch the next couple of episodes how it all ties together, but he just looks so shocked and like quite vulnerable himself, actually, when he witnessed that, and that kind of interested me, and I'm trying to remember how it all pieces together, because obviously they do sort of get the better of Gerard in the end. And now I'm curious to basically see all of how the pieces tie together while paying attention.
Yeah, I don't really remember either, like, if it has a big significance as far as him knowing that Gerard is now the Cannimus master, but I think it tells a lot about the type of person that Peter is. I mean, if Scott had seen what Gerard would have been doing, he would have stopped Gerard. He would have gotten in there and would have saved Matt's life, regardless of what happened. And I think you know, Derek would have too. I think a lot of the other people would. But Peter didn't. He saw it, he backed away, he let it happen. And so I think that's very telling of the type of person that Peter is.
Yeah, I mean, it's also interesting that he looks quite scared of Gerard, or quite
mm-hmm.
horrified when he was the, you know, he was the big bad before, so...
Right.
I mean, I barely see Peter as a villain now, though. Like, I keep forgetting that he is sort of a bad guy, because...
Yeah.
Not even because what he did isn't bad, but because in context of the show, like, other people's are so much worse, and that he's just like, oh, that's kind of, like, vaguely reasonable, like, kind of, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And like, comparing to Gerard or even to Matt, like, it's just... but then you have to go and sit back and be like, well, Peter, like, killed Derek's sister for,
right,
know, whatever reason, and it's all, I don't know, just... Gerard, you know, if Peter was bad and Gerard is worse, it makes me worry what might come next.
Right, that's true. Or how bad this wolf pack, this alpha pack is going to be.
Mm.
Yeah, that's a good question. All right, we are going to get into our news section right now. Let's start off with these couple bits of casting news that we have. And I'm sure I'm going to murder this poor girl's last name, but I'll try my best. Anna Walczak is cast as Laura now, and then we have Alicia Coppola, who will be Talia, and she's going to be Derek's mother. So, you know, obviously we don't know a whole lot about what these characters are going to be like in the flashback episodes or what purpose they have, that sort of thing.
Mm.
I mean, we do to an extent, but not a whole lot of information, but... You know, just physically from their appearances and stuff, do you think that these two actresses are going to make good Hale werewolves?
Yeah, definitely. I think they look great. Like, I mean, they all look really cool. Like, for Derek's family, they all look somewhat alike. They look very mm-hmm. much like, I think, what people's image of them has been. I like that in the picture of the article that you put on the website, you've just put a picture of Derek looking sad.
Oh my gosh. Okay, to find that picture, like, I type this into Google probably more times than I should, but I literally search for Derek Hale sad to find pictures for articles sometimes, because, well, first of all, the girl who's going to be playing Laura, she's basically been in two shorts, and so this is really her first, it's definitely her first television debut, but really her first major role, I would assume, even as a guest star. And so there really were no pictures that I could find of her, and the ones that I did weren't the right size. So I was like, all right, what can I put in its place? Well, I'll just find a picture of Derek looking really sad.
It's amazing. But yeah, no, I think that they look cool, like, especially his mum. I think that looks really just like what I imagined. So I'm excited to see what we will have. Obviously, this is going to be a little younger than, obviously, Laura of nowadays, like Laura of apparently crying in the bleachers or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll be, yeah, I think I'm just, I'm afraid it's going to hurt too much, Karen. They'll be too cute and it'll be too sad.
I know, I'm really looking forward to Laura, and I think getting to know her more is just going to be really painful to remember that she's died, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I just, yeah, it's going to be tough.
It is quite, they're casting so many people. I'm going to be really amazed at how,
yeah.
How many new characters. It's going to be too much. I'm going to have, too many people and too much loveliness. And they all seem to be, like, really important characters, so.
Right, yeah. I know, and they're all so beautiful. Like, I didn't think the cast could get more beautiful, and then here they find, like, all these new people, and it's just like, where do you find them? They're all gorgeous.
Mm-hmm. Good
it's
times.
Unfair. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just I'm basically just really excited for the Hales in general.
Me too. Yeah, it's going to be really exciting. This flashback episode is, I think it's going to be really pivotal, not just to the season, but to the whole series. I think it's going to give us a lot of what we've been looking for since we learned about what happened to Derek. So it's definitely, I'd say, probably the most anticipated episode of season 3 so far. A lot of people seem to be really excited about it.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, it's something that I'm just really actually glad that these characters are going to come in, like the Hales, because they are people that, you know, obviously have been referenced before, and it wasn't known whether they'd ever come back to it, you know, that we'd ever come back to these characters, or whether they were just sort of, oh, they were people that existed before. And, you know, I don't know how long they've been planned for, if you know what I mean. Like, if they've always been... Because people have such a strong idea, obviously, with... Especially Laura, she's a character in fandom that people have really given an identity to, like, and, you know, built ideas about. And so it's going to be interesting to see if she is like what people thought she was going to be like.
Right. Yeah, because I sort of... From what I've seen, and I haven't seen a whole lot of fan fiction and stuff, but, you know, I do browse a little bit, and she seems to be portrayed as, like, the outgoing person to Derek, sort of introvert, and I'm not quite sure that theory is necessarily going to hold up. I mean, she could still be outgoing, but from what we've heard about young Derek is that he's a star athlete, he's very charming. He seems to be quite outgoing, too, so I'm very curious to see their dynamic when it finally comes to screen.
Yeah, for sure.
The next big thing is actually about Danny, and this was some information that a lot of people were really happy about, and it's just a quote from the actor Akiyahu, and he says, "Danny is definitely, whether intentional or not, being brought more into everything going on. It does somewhat have to do with his involvement in his new relationship, and we know that his new relationship is going to be with Ethan, one of the Alpha Pack members." So what do you think about Danny getting a little bit closer to all of this stuff with the werewolves going on in Beacon Hills?
Good, but don't let him get killed.
Yeah, I know. Oh, there would be a riot, Natalie. Seriously. Like, I mean, not that I put that beyond Jeff, because I have a feeling he likes to play with, you know, our heartstrings a little bit. Yeah.
It would be like a really... I don't want to say this, but it would be a really good way of showing how bad someone was if they would have killed Danny, if you know what I mean. Like, if, like, say... Ethan or whatever really loved him or whatever, and then Deucalion was like, "None for you, Ethan," and killed Danny. Oh. It would be like the worst. Like, it would be like,
yeah,
you know how it would just be so bad, and I just couldn't handle it. Like,
yeah, I think the fandom would have to go into mourning. I mean, there's really, aside from like Styles, I don't think there's another character that people would be that upset about if they were killed off or if anything happened to them.
And Styles being killed off would be horrible, but it would also be more incidental. Like, it would also be more like part of his own plot line, like, you know, something maybe that was like he got himself in the way of, or, you know, he was saving someone else or something like that. Danny would be like a really innocent death of, like, someone who is just good and innocent, if you know what I mean. So it would be really, really bad.
Yeah, definitely. So speaking of the relationship, too, Kiahu says that he says the relationship seems genuine. And now, I don't necessarily believe this, because I think that, you know, he's probably instructed to just say that sort of thing so that we build up this idea that, you know, Ethan does care about him, and then when Ethan turns on him or something, we're going to be even more shocked. So I'm taking it with a grain of salt, but, I mean, we've definitely talked about before the fact that it would be really great if Ethan did sort of fall in love with Danny and change sides and that sort of thing, and I mean, just taking what he's saying here, that definitely seems like a possibility. So what do you think about that?
Again, I don't know, but I want it to be real. Like, I want that thing. I want that thing of, like, oh, it started as a lie, but it became true, you know, and I was just putting my hand to, you know, my hand to my forehead in a dramatic sweeping gesture. and, you know, a thing for Ethan where it became something really complex, and it makes him turn his coat. Like, that's what I want. That's what I want. And I don't know if that's what'll happen, but I don't want someone to mess with Danny or him to get killed or anything like that. So the only solution for me is that it's real.
Yeah. Okay. Hey, that's logical to me. Why not? So we knew this before, that Boyd was going to get more of a backstory this season, which I'm definitely looking forward to. I want to know more about him. But Jeff, in his Tumblr Q&A that he did, said, and this was his last question, he was so horrible. He was like, yeah, Boyd had sisters. Thanks for your questions. I'm leaving now. Bye. And I was like, wait, you're really going to leave us on that? So Boyd definitely had sisters. What do we think happened to them?
Dear God.
I think that it's supernatural related to that sort of thing. And maybe that's even part of the reason why he wanted to become a werewolf. Or do you think it was just, you know, an accident or something unrelated?
Maybe he killed them in a rage, like Albus Dumbledore and his boyfriend Grindelwald. like, as it's since becoming a werewolf.
That would be intense.
And I don't know. Like, maybe... I don't know. I feel like that a lot of people die in this show. That's a really sweeping statement. But, like, I feel like too many people... I feel like it's unrealistic that that many people's families have died naturally, if you know what I mean, like prior to, like, that, you know, that Isaac's brother died in combat and that Stiles' mother's died, and that I feel like with all of that, like, that Boy isn't necessarily, that his sisters, if he had sisters, that it may not have been necessarily, yeah, just another incidental family death, because there's been a lot of those, like, so this one may actually be to do with the werewolves, yeah.
Right. That makes sense, yeah. Okay, so then our last little bit of news, which I know everybody at the podcast is pretty excited about, is that Dylan is going to be on New Girl on April 30th in the episode titled Virgin. So how did you react when you first heard this news?
I love New Girl so much. It's like my favorite comedy at the moment, like, or of the past few years. I think it's genius and it's ridiculous because I was such a big anti-fan of Zooey Deschanel before this show. Like, I was literally like, oh my god, I hate her, she's such a faux hipster, she's so annoying, her eyes are too wide, and, like, this show, well, the concept of this show was like, oh, she's, like, this quirky girl who, like, oh, you know, she's the ugly girl, and all her friends are models, and this is how it was pitched. It was like, oh, she's sick of living with her model friends and being, like, the little weird one, and, you know, so she has to move in with this apartment of guys, and I'm like, yeah, okay, so she's meant to be, like, the unpretty one and the weird one, and it's gonna be all quirky. Okay, no, but no, it is amazing. The writing is so good. Like, it's such good comedy writing. Liz Merriweather, the creator, she's only written a couple of things, and the other, when I actually started watching New Girl, and then I looked her up, I found that this actually made a lot of sense because, yeah, she's written this movie called No Strings Attached, which is Natalie Portman and Ashton Kutcher, and it sounds like whatever, like, it's like a romantic comedy, haha, like, you know, friends and whatever in a relationship, but the writing in it is extraordinary. Like, it's unusually good and unusually realistic, and she's the same writer that wrote New Girl, and New Girl has the same quality of this unusual, style of realism that is really, really likable. Like, I just think it's so much better than a lot of the shows, and Schmidt is, like, my baby. Like, I love him so much. And Dylan, like, is just such he's such a high quality actor that he's, like, perfect for this show. Like, it's such, it's just such a good quality comedy show. Like, I can't imagine a better fit for him if he was going to move to a sitcom, if you know what I mean. Like, I'd hate to see him on something, like, really forced, even though I like some comedies that are quite forced, like Big Bang Theory and stuff like that. I'd hate to see him on that. It's not his style of acting, but New Girl has that naturalistic style that is going to be really good for him. And yeah, so he's apparently going to be in a flashback as the guy who goes to prom with Jess. And the girl who's played Jess in the flashback, like, we've had quite a few flashbacks of Jess as young, so that should be fun. Like, it should be really, really good.
Yeah, and I mean, we know that on New Girl they do a lot of improv-type stuff, and, I mean, Dylan, we know that he kind of excels at that sort of thing, so I'm really excited to see what he's going to be able to come up with and what he can add by himself. But also, yeah, like you were saying, the writing is just phenomenal. It's so funny, and it's got a lot of heart, too. I'm not the type of person that likes stupid comedies, like a lot of the Will Ferrell movies and that sort of thing. Like, yeah. That's just not my style at all. But New Girl is very funny, very heartfelt, and, yeah, it's just a really great fit for him. I'm really excited.
Yeah, it's really cool. It's interesting that to me that he got to guest star on that, because it's another network, it's Fox, and I have no idea how people's contracts work, but I was under the impression that it's quite difficult to guest star on another network when you're contracted to a certain network. Maybe it's a difference between cable and the other networks, I don't know, but...
Yeah, I was going to say, because MTV is sort of a separate entity. Yeah, it's not quite like he was moving between, you know, Fox and ABC and, you know, those sort of things, so maybe it was a bit easier for him. All right, so getting into our listener feedback now, we've got three of them here. The first one comes from Blue Humac from Twitter. Now that we know for sure that Danny will be dating one of the twin alphas, do you think he'll become a werewolf too? And at first, you know, my first reaction is to say no. However, we did learn from that same Q&A that somebody will be turning into a werewolf, and that it's not necessarily going to happen in the usual way. And also there's, you know, the thing about Danny's last name meaning like moon or something like that. And all of this just sort of makes me wonder if it's possible.
I think it's not implausible. Oh, I don't know if I want it, but it's not implausible. Yeah. I feel like if they made the name like that on purpose, that it will come into play in some way.
Right. I was sort of, like, trying to come up with reasons why it could mean that and not necessarily have to do with him turning into a werewolf. Like, maybe, you know, in his past he has something to do with it, or, you know, his ancestors were not necessarily hunters, but, you know, that it could have something to do with something else other than the fact that he turns into a werewolf.
Yeah. Like what?
I don't know. Like, he's sort of... Okay, so, like, the moon has its control over werewolves, so maybe Danny is able to convince Ethan, you know, to turn good or something like that. You know, something sort of abstract like that.
Yeah, I could go with that, yeah. maybe whatever the thing that Deaton is like some sort of, maybe you have to have something special about you, like some magical quality or something, and maybe Danny has it.
Yeah, I'd be down for that. That'd be cool. And then Deaton could take Danny under his wing and teach him how to be a little werewolf advisor. That would be cool.
Yeah. Because, I mean, people have thought, oh, maybe that's the situation with Styles, but I don't know. Like, maybe it could be, maybe Danny could have something to him in regards to that.
Definitely interesting. Definitely going to be keeping an eye on Danny in season 3, because we know he has a bigger role, and I'm definitely curious to see where they take that and how it ends up. Our next bit of feedback is from Tumblr. This is from Anonymous, and they said, you guys forgot to mention how Lydia's or how awesome Lydia's skills were figure skating, unless I missed it, which I don't think you did. For some reason, she's good at a lot of things, and I find it quite strange. She got bored with Latin, learned archaic Latin, knows French, all-around book smart, amazing at bowling. She's strangely immune and can figure skate almost like a pro. This all at 16 as well. Maybe this isn't a coincidence, and she is some sort of witch or something of that sort. And this is a really good point, and it's actually something that sort of bothered me with Lydia. I mean, obviously she's extremely intelligent, and it isn't beyond a person's capability to know all of this stuff, but the fact that she does seem to sort of have all the answers and be amazing at everything she tries and be incredibly popular on top of that is something that I've always kind of side-eyed. You know, it's always been a little tough to think of that as realistic, but I like the idea that maybe she's some sort of witch or she is special where everything just sort of comes naturally to her.
Yeah, I mean, it makes me think, at the very least, it kind of, it's almost like she's like a savant, like she has like a prodigy, like it's more than just, oh, I'm smart, if you know what I mean, or I'm talented. She does seem to have a very unusual knack for, taking in knowledge or for, you know, doing what she attempts. And in the real world, it would be like a sort of strange savantism, but in this, it definitely could be supernatural, seeing as the immunity thing comes into play as well.
Right.
I don't know what it could be, but Lydia being immune, as we sort of discussed, we don't know why that happened. We don't know if it's something to do with her or something to do with something that was done to her. But if it is to do with just her, it could be that, you know, she didn't turn into a werewolf because she's not human and the bite only works on humans or something like that. Like that she is actually something else, though I don't know what that would be.
Right, that could be interesting, yeah.
It also makes me think, that maybe she's sort of, some kind of sleeper agent, like not, you know, that, if you know what I mean, like that she is not aware that she is completely something else and is completely not aware of it, and then that will be activated in some way.
That would be really cool. Oh, I hope they do that.
That's the only thing I can think of, yeah.
Yeah, that would be cool. That'd be a nice plot twist, too. I don't think a whole lot of, well, obviously, other than you, a whole lot of people would see that sort of thing coming, so that could be cool. Mm. All right, last piece of feedback is from Quiet Fever, also of Tumblr, and they say, Allison was always Scott's anchor, of course. Without the relationship next season, do you think that Scott's ability to control himself will decrease, or do we think that he has matured to the point where he's able to control his abilities on his own without an anchor? Clearly, Derek still needs his anchor, but that doesn't necessarily mean that Scott needs one. Keep up the good work, ladies. Aw, thank you. Yeah, this is actually something I hadn't thought of, but it makes a lot of sense that Scott might have a little bit more trouble controlling himself without Allison around and without them having a very good relationship. I think that he hasn't matured enough to the point where he doesn't need the anchor, because I think the anchor is something that everybody uses. And Derek, if anybody doesn't need an anchor, it's probably going to be Derek, because he is a natural born werewolf, and you know, he's been at this for a very long time, obviously, and he's a little bit more worldly than Scott is. So I think that Scott still needs his anchor, and I think that it's definitely a possibility that he's going to be having a little bit more trouble controlling himself next season. Although I hope they don't go into it too much, because that was a lot of what season one was about, and I just really don't want it to feel repetitive.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, what I was going to say is I don't think that he's in any way a talented enough werewolf or whatever, you know, an experienced enough werewolf to not need an anchor, especially when it was so volatile to start with, when his, you know, feelings were so volatile to start with. So, my first instinct is to say that we would be dealing with that, like with his not having Allison, but second instinct is, what you say, that it would be quite repetitive. So I'm sure they'll find a way to to make whatever happens, happens, without, you know, rehashing that whole, how do I cope with my control kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, as I said earlier, that if we are going to see something like that happen, it may happen with Derek's anchor changing due to him getting too happy.
Right, yep.
So that is everything for episodes 209 and 210. The next episode that we have coming for you will be our interview with Chantel, talking about her experiences working on 209 and working on season 3 as well, which is really cool. So she was very kind enough to speak to us and was allowed to speak to us a little bit from the Teen Wolf team officially. So that's kind. That's very exciting to have someone who's been on the set to come on the podcast and talk to us about everything that happened. So you can expect that episode to come, yeah, in a few days. And then after that, we'll be doing episodes for the finale. For 2.11 and 2.12, we're actually going to focus a whole episode on each. They might not be a full 2 hours each, but we're going to spend, you know, 1 week at a time looking at each of the final two episodes because they're very intense.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, we will have either a few bite sizes if we can get them in, or, you know, big recap of season 3 news before we get season 3 starting this summer.
Oh, yay! I'm so excited!
Yay! Okay, so I'll say bye to you now, everyone, and bye to Karen.
Bye, guys.
Bye-bye. Bye.